As you may have noticed, this month's show is a little late. You may also have noticed that the show is starting without music. In light of the events in New Orleans earlier this month, we will be talking with Michael Barnett, a former Special Forces soldier-turned-crisis manager for Drecknik.com, a domain name registration company based in New Orleans, Louisiana. Michael, better known as Interdictor, has been blogging about his experiences during and after the storm, a blog that caught the eye of thousands, perhaps millions, worldwide. Next month, we will return to our regular format and will bring you the interview with Dr. Bill Youngs that we told you about in last month's show. Out of respect for the lives lost and the damage done, we want to take this moment at the beginning of the podcast to express our deepest and most heartfelt sorrow for those who had nothing and now have even less, and especially for those dead and dying as we speak. As many of you know, I am not religious, but the majority of those affected by Katrina are. May God be with you in these trying times. So, first and foremost, what the hell are you still doing there?
Well, I'm skeleton crew. That is keeping the data center up and running until the company figures out exactly what approach it's going to take into the future. So the owners right now are looking at various other sites to move a primary location to for a data center, and then this one will probably become the backup data center. So someone has to stay here and man the station until such time as everything gets moved out.
Now, are you an actual Drecknik employee, or are you just working as a consultant?
I am an informal consultant for my best friend, who is the CEO, Sigmund Solaris, and I've been an informal consultant for him for years. And when this hurricane was coming around, he asked me if I could come into the data center and help him, you know, hold the fort down. And he nicknamed me the crisis manager at that point, instead of the informal consultant.
What did you do before you worked at Drecknik?
Well, a lot of things, actually. I worked at Entergy briefly doing some legal abstracting. I guess that was in 2000, 2001. But then since then, I've been working with Drecknik as a consultant on a part-time basis. And before that, I was in college and doing the military at the same time. So basically, the jobs I had before this were Entergy, 2000, 2001, I think part of 2002, and then Drecknik since then.
Now, you and Team Sodi rode out the storm on the 10th floor of a 27-story building. Can you tell us what it was like before, during, and after the storm?
Yeah, well, before the storm, it was, I guess, we weren't really nervous. We were more busy, and we were running around trying to secure everything, take stock and inventory of what we had, figure out what the living arrangements were going to be like, and just basically battening down the hatches, getting ready for the thing to hit. During the storm, I guess power got knocked out to the 11th floor, which is where we were holed up above the data center. And then we moved everything down. We moved our personal items and whatnot. We went down to the 10th floor and went ahead and holed up in the data center itself. Most of us got some sleep when the storm was actually hitting, but when the building started creaking and actually swaying back and forth into the blinds, that's when a few of us got up and started taking pictures of the storm and trying to catch some video of it and that kind of thing. After the storm, we began assessing damage to the building, damage to the surrounding area, flooding, and looking for any kind of other security threats that we could have physically, mostly in the general area. So we started taking stock, you know, after the thing hit.
You said you're not going to comply with the mandatory evacuation because you're exempt. What gives you that status?
Well, they're already letting people back into the city, so the mandatory evacuation is kind of moot at this point anyway. We weren't going to comply anyway, first of all, because, I mean, we can't just do that to our customers, just let the internet go down. You know, like, I don't know if you're aware, it's about 2% of the internet runs through Intercosmos and Drecknik through this data center that's here. You know, if we walk out and just say, okay, fine, we're out of here, and let everything shut down, that's a lot of people's livelihoods that are just, you know, that's it. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, we were not a liability to the city. We were a self-contained operation up here, and we were actually assisting, you know, we were offering comfort to police officers who were who needed help, they were abandoned basically by their units. We also helped restore communication with City Hall and provided equipment and communications to the command and control infrastructure throughout the city. So, I mean, we were providing services to the city in addition to all of our customers and basically helping out people. So we didn't see any reason why we should evacuate. We weren't in the way. You know, if they had come up here and physically thrown us out, we would have left. But, you know, we weren't going to go on our own.
I was reading through your blog again today, all the way back to the beginning. And early on, you seem really upbeat and positive about, you know, doing the job and getting through it. And you seem to become more and more cynical as time wore on. Would you attribute this to just being tired and worn out, or more to watching the situation in NOLA deteriorate?
I think it was a combination of both. I think, you know, I had a huge adrenaline rush for maybe a week or 10 days. And I was living on adrenaline, really. I mean, we were doing some hard work, but I was upbeat and had that adrenaline rush because of everything that was going on. And we were getting the job done, and we were proud of the fact that we had maintained the connectivity during the storm. And then I guess it started that day that we were taking pictures up on top of the roof of our building and just surveying the devastation of the city. And, you know, growing up here in New Orleans, it just hurt. It hurt to look around and just see and know how long it would take to get this back, if ever, you know, that the city could possibly make a comeback. You know, and to this day, I hear what they're saying, but I'm not all that positive that they're being realistic. On top of that, I had to send my fiance packing out of here. I sent her to Tampa to stay with some friends, just because it was safe at that time for her to be evacuated out of here. And I just felt, you know, I knew it would be better for her and better for me and just better all around that, you know, safer for her just to have her not here. That kind of was a little bit depressing, you know, because I didn't have her for comfort and support anymore. And as the adrenaline rush was wearing off on me. And then listening to the political speeches and Jesse Jackson and everyone pointing fingers and blaming when they're all missing the point. The point is that, you know, government's always going to have a slow response time. It's the nature of government. It's bureaucracy. All that kind of stuff. It just started building up, and I guess, you know, it is a little bit depressing when you throw all those factors in together. And then as I got out and got to survey more of the damage, not just from the roof, but just in general in my car looking around, I mean, it's pretty bad out there. And it's, you know, it is depressing. And I came to a realization that I was going to move. You know, I'm not going to stay here. It's going to be a long time before it's business as usual here. And even if you do open a business, you're not going to get that many customers, and you're not going to have that many products that you're going to be able to buy either. I mean, I don't even know how many grocery stores are going to reopen down here, or bookstores, or who knows what. I mean, there's going to be scarcity in that, you know, as far as that goes. You might have more money than you can spend down here. If you want to know the truth, there might just not be that many services available. So all those things put together, I mean, it wore me down. Fatigue, all of it, you know.
You seem to leave the building and patrol the city pretty frequently. What purpose do you have for these patrols?
The purpose for the patrols was, first of all, the civil unrest. I mean, it was chaotic out there for a while. You know, when I interviewed that police officer, and he told me about how their whole precinct, I think it was 5th Precinct, was just wiped out. I mean, they were underwater. They had no command and control, no communication, no police cars. They had to go commandeer police cars out of showroom floors at some of the various car dealerships. You have that in combination with the wild looting. You had the raping and murdering going on at both the convention center and the Superdome. The citizens were panicked because they were told that they were going to be evac'd out on buses, but then buses never showed up. And they have to feed their babies, and they have to feed themselves, and no one has medicine, and the troops hadn't come in yet, and it was utter chaos out there. So my patrols were oriented toward keeping this building physically secure and making sure nobody got in, and also making sure that the people who were already in here were safe, you know, from anyone coming in from outside. And I mean, that's that took a lot. We had to tie down doors. We had to turn off a building generator, which powered some of the electronic doors and gates to the garage. We had to basically patrol the parking garage, make sure nobody had found a way in, patrol some of the floors, you know, if we found any open doors, that kind of thing. So that's what that was about, you know, just our own physical safety.
When you guys are out on that patrol, do you ever stop and help the people that you see?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I don't know if you saw the entry where Sigmund actually reunited that girl that got left by her family.
Yeah, that's right.
With the family. And then we passed out food and some supplies a few times, and we did what we could. For the most part, we didn't want to go down to the street too much, because that is where we would become a liability. You know, if we're getting in the way of the police or getting in the way of the military or anything like that, then we would have to leave, you know. So when we were doing our patrols, we stuck as close to the building as possible. If we could help people out, we did. We passed information on to the masses that were coming in, telling them what we knew, what we were told, where people should go, stuff we heard on the radio or stuff that we read on the internet, and then we passed information back to the public from the people that we talked to on the street. So we helped in that respect too, especially with the flow of information. But I mean, there's only so much we could really do before, you know, if we passed out all of our food, then we would have to leave also, you know. So there was a fine line that we had to draw there and figure out what, you know, what we could do to help without us ourselves becoming a liability that needed to be bussed out too.
Well, how far in advance did you prepare and build up supplies before it actually came to it?
Well, the funny thing about that is that the hurricane was not the reason that we had all these supplies on hand. The owner and CEO, Sigmund Solaris, stockpiled food in the building already because he served lunch to the employees, about 50 employees, twice a week. And he doesn't just buy a few days out. He buys in bulk, basically 3 weeks to a month in advance. So he's buying food for 50 employees for twice a week for about a month in advance, and that was a huge supply of food. So when we had a skeleton crew of about four or five people here, you know, we had enough food to... We're still eating. I'm still living on the same food, and I'm not even close to running out. So that's why there was such a stockpile of stuff here. But then he has tremendous organizational skills too, and this whole place is organized. Everything is labeled and separated. We have extra clothes here. Funny story about that also is he had a failed business venture where he had some thousands of T-shirts printed up. So, yeah, so, you know, those things were just sitting around. So we use those as rags, as shirts, as any, you know, basically mop up stuff off the floor when we had some flooding from the rainwater, not from the ground, but, you know, when some windows broke, that kind of thing. So we had extra supplies that we weren't thinking that we're going to end up being supplies, but that's how that went. So when the hurricane came, basically all we needed to do was make sure we had batteries and flashlights and that kind of thing, but again, we were already stockpiled with those too, so it really didn't require that much extra preparation before this thing hit.
Around midnight on September 7th, you had some unexpected visitors. Can you tell us that story?
I believe you're talking about the U.S. Marshal with the 82nd Airborne guys that came up. Basically, most of us were asleep. I think a couple of guys were up just because we never had everybody asleep at the same time, just in case of a fire or because we needed a guard or whatnot. And these guys burst into the office area, into the data center, and at gunpoint started rounding everybody up. And they told us that they saw lights on in the building and that one of the doors, one of the emergency exits downstairs, was not secured. Well, I knew for a fact that Sigmund and I had secured it. We had spent most of the day securing all the doors. And when we went down and investigated later, you could see where it was cut, and it looked like it was cut with a bayonet, you know, a military knife. So these guys told us that they figured the building was unsecured. They saw lights, and they came up and wanted to investigate. And it was my contention that they were probably bored doing the foot patrols that they were doing around the city, and just figured that they would I don't want to say liven things up by harassing people, but maybe they just felt like investigating something that they otherwise would have not bothered with. So they came up and they poked around, but they were a little bit bullish about it at first by sticking their guns in some people's faces up here. It was obvious that we're not just up here, looting the place. Everything's still in place, and we were maintaining the data center. So I asked them politely if the door was unsecured, could they go ahead and do the rest of the building, all 27 floors, And, of course, they were going to have to do that on foot because the elevators weren't working at the time. And I didn't feel bad about doing that at all because, they came busting in here with guns, and I knew that they were the ones that opened the door. But either way, whether they open the door or someone else opened the door, at that point the building is unsecured and does need to be swept. And since that ostensibly was their reason for coming up in the first place, then they needed to go ahead and finish the sweep and not just stop at our floor where they found some people minding their own business.
We've all heard the reports of basic utilities being unavailable, so the question has to be asked, where are you going to the bathroom?
I've avoided answering that question because it's just pretty nasty, and if your listeners really want to know, I can go into detail.
I don't think we need a lot of detail. I think
just
curious, how does it work? I mean, it is definitely a concern because we always hear that that's one of the big problems right now is
well, yeah. And I saw in one news report some guy stole a porta potty from a construction site and was cleaning it out every day.
There's 27 floors and 2 bathrooms on each floor. And let's just say most of them are unusable at this point. So that's primary. And then there were some secondary ways with plastic bags and that kind of thing. And, you can cut stuff out of boxes and to make seats. And just it's not pretty. It really isn't, But
when necessity calls, right?
Yeah.
Right. And I wouldn't want to have to be one of the people that's going to be doing the janitorial services in this building for a while. That's all I'm going to say about that.
So besides that, what have your immediate dangers been mostly leading up to now? I think obviously you're pretty safe now. I read you sort of put your weapons away and whatnot, and you feel very secure. But especially when, right after the storm moved out and their looters and everything were like that, were around and whatnot, what were your immediate dangers?
Well, the immediate dangers were primarily, like you said, the people on the ground who were up to no good. Then other dangers were the fires that were breaking out all over the city, and some were set, and some, set by arsonists, and some weren't. Then there was, the random shootings that were going on. Apparently there were some troublemaking snipers around the city, some civilian criminal types who were just enjoying shooting at people, police officers and everybody else. So that was another one. Then there's always the threat that when the electricity comes back on, that can start fires. There was the threat of pollutants and biocontaminants and that kind of thing that was ever present, especially near the floodwater areas down the street. There was the threat of, intimidating police officers and military types who, might be their first deployment to any place with any civil unrest, and maybe they're enjoying a little bit too much getting to wield their weaponry. So we had a guy that had the police point their weapons at him on more than one occasion. I mean, I don't know how many people out there listening have ever had a gun pointed in his or her face, but, it's not a pleasant experience. And especially if you're not a criminal, I would imagine you would have an even bigger problem with it. But so there were all of those things. And then the thing that we were most scared about, I wouldn't call it a danger, but our whole reason for being here, which was to keep this data center up and running, there were times when we were close to running out of fuel. And that probably was the thing that made us most nervous, because that would have made all of this whole ordeal for naught. We would have just had to pack up at that point and leave if we couldn't have kept the data center up and powered. So those were the main concerns and dangers that we faced.
So how has your military training come into play been useful?
My military training came into play in a few areas. Like, first and foremost, obviously, was the physical security. Securing the building, showing everybody, making sure everybody knew how to use the weapons we had up here, making sure that the weapons were operable, and that the ammunition, you know, all that kind of related stuff, making sure that the sweeps that we were performing were conducted properly, that we weren't going to miss anything, that we were going to do everything right, as far as that goes. And then the military training came in with the sanitation aspects. It also came in with the rationing and some of the field expedient measures. We have, for instance, taking a shower, where we actually built sort of a shower out of a file cabinet and an igloo 5-gallon ice chest sort of thing, and stand under it and shower. But then we don't just let the water run down the drain on the floor. We save it, collect it, fill it into these big rubber garbage cans, and then use that later to flush waste away and that kind of thing. So, I mean, a whole variety of aspects with regard to physical safety, sanitation, rationing, and the like. I mean, I think that the military played a large part with that respect. But then also with just keeping a cool head, you know, in a rough time. That's basically what the number one thing they train you for in the military is to not to just lose it emotionally or anything like that, but to just follow procedures that you practice over and over and over again, so they become natural when you are under stress. And that's an invaluable skill, and that's something, you know, everyone should work on, practicing keeping his head in a crisis situation. Because it just causes more problems when you don't. You know, if someone's bleeding or needs some kind of physical attention immediately, you can't have other people freaking out. That just completely hurts the whole cause. So that's probably the primary way that the military training came into play.
Like, how many other people there have any kind of experience with that? Was it kind of like you just in charge retraining them, or?
Well, I was in charge of management of the situation. Sigmund, the CEO who was here, he was in charge of the actual decision making. But Sigmund's also an Eagle Scout, and in fact, at one time he was the youngest person ever to become an Eagle Scout. I think he had just turned 13 when he made Eagle Scout, so he actually had some kind of citation for that. But he had some basic experience with some of these things, but I was the only person with any formal military training, as far as that goes.
So when are you getting out of there?
The word is that Monday, I'm not sure what, I don't even know what the date is, but I don't even know what today's date is, honestly. I've kind of lost track. But the word is that I will be done here on Monday. And at that point in time, I am going to go to my apartment, which I understand has not taken any damage, which does have power and electricity. I'm going to empty out my apartment and drive my stuff over to my parents' house, which is just a couple of miles away from my apartment. And then pack up the stuff I need, like my clothes and maybe some of my music and my computer and stuff like that. And then I'm going to drive to Tampa, the Tampa area, and we found a nice place in Largo. Crystal found it, and I'm going to move in there and start a new life, you know, in a different hurricane zone.
Yeah.
So are you looking forward to leaving?
Well, they're paying me a hefty sum, and you know, on a daily basis, so... part of me is like, I can't wait to see Crystal again, and I can't wait, you know, to get to Florida and just start my new life. But then on the other side, there is still stuff to do here, and I am still being paid and that kind of thing. So, you know, part of me wants to stay and see this thing all the way through. But I think by the time Monday rolls around, that'll be the third week since the storm probably. And I mean, realistically, you know, I'm not a superhero. You know, I think highly of my skills and that kind of thing, but I should probably get rotated out, you know, and get some R&R. I've noticed, I don't know if you can tell reading the blog, it's not just my spirits that have shifted a little bit. I've caught myself making so many typographical and grammatical and spelling mistakes that I wasn't making right off the bat, and I've been getting clumsier around here. I've spilled things a few times. I got diesel in my eyes the other day. Just I'm getting clumsy and that kind of thing, and that's all a sign of fatigue and strain and that kind of thing. So from an objective point of view, I really should get out of here. for a little while at least. And I guess I am kind of looking forward to it in that respect.
Now, you sound pretty good. How are you talking to us? Is that a cell phone or VoIP or something?
Yeah, voice over IP.
And did you guys set that up?
One of the guys from one of the companies that shares part of the data center with us, he set it up. I would name him, but he asked me to take all references to him out of the blog and that kind of thing. Not because he was upset or anything, just he likes his anonymity, so. But anyway, he did it. And that same guy, who I'm not allowed to mention, unfortunately, he's the one that mainly kept our connectivity up and running. And you know, he's done all the telecommunications kind of stuff. He's been the tech guy that's really supported this operation. He's done a fabulous job. And one day, hopefully, when this is all over, he'll let me, you know, name him again. But he's the man. And, you know, this all might have been for naught if he hadn't been here also. So.
With everything that's happened, a lot of people have been pointing fingers from the president on down. Now, the president has accepted blame for the lackadaisical federal response, but who do you think is to blame for insufficient response by the city?
Oh, I mean, you'd have to blame so many people because it's a systemic problem as well as an individual problem. The way that government has been run in this city and this state for the last, I don't know, 300 years, we have a reputation for corruption and everything. So no problems ever get solved down here by government. And so government's never prepared for anything that hits down here. It's just the most corrupt system you could ever imagine. And it draws some of the most corrupt people you could ever imagine, into its ranks. So it's a combination of the system itself down here, the let the good times roll atmosphere we have, the corrupt atmosphere of government where you've got to grease everybody's palms before you can get a permit to do anything down here. I mean, I don't think your listeners, unless they're from here, could possibly relate. It makes the daily stuff, you know, up in Chicago look like some clean Vatican kind of operation or something. Oh, maybe that's not a good, I don't know if that's the right one. But anyway, it makes, in other words, this is the most corrupt area. And then the people that get into government down here, like the Morial administration and even the ones that are claiming to clean up, like Nagin and whatnot. I mean, Nagin ran a monopoly cable company down here where he was basically providing a horrible cable service at high prices because he had no competition. You know, I hate to get on this roll because I'm not a big fan of government at all, and I'm not a fan of the people that go into government, be they Democrats, Republicans, or Independents. I kind of align myself with the Libertarians, and I think that government usually creates more problems than it solves. But if you want me to really point fingers, I mean, I'll point fingers at the police department's horrible preparedness. They were completely unprepared for this. Their response was, therefore, exactly what you would expect, incompetent. The City Hall was unprepared. How come City Hall didn't have generators keeping them up and running, you know, with diesel backup like we did? I mean, they have way more resources than we do. We didn't go down once, but they, you know, they got crushed on the first night. And so I would blame the state the same, you know, for the same reasons, and I would blame the federal government for the same reasons. So, you know, you get what you get with government, and that is, look, I mean, FEMA was keeping people, from what I understand, the private sector was ready to roll in with trucks on day one. They said Walmart had truckload after truckload just waiting to come in for relief, and FEMA was turning them away. So, I mean, I think if you want to know the truth, we would have been better off with no government response in a lot of ways than with any government response. I mean, they put those firefighters out there getting sexual harassment training and passing out flyers instead of getting them into the city, actually putting fires out. So I don't know if you guys were familiar with that story, but I think I linked it on the blog at one point. Anyway, you know, who are you going to point fingers at? All those guys in politics I point the finger at. So, sorry about that long-winded little rant, but that's how I feel about it.
Oh, that's fine. So, speaking about Mayor Nagin, people outside of New Orleans have sort of been looking upon him as somewhat of a hero for his blunt and outspoken thoughts, and it sounds like you don't think he should be revered as such, do you?
No, I don't think he's a hero at all. I mean, I think he's a politician. And And anyone can get up and make a good speech, you know, and say, you know, blank this and blank that, and you do your blah blah this and whatever, and start yelling at people. But that's still, if you ask me, that's contrived political rhetoric. That's not, I don't think that's any more authentic than any other speech a politician gives. It's just, okay, well, in this situation, let me refer to politician playbook, you know, B here. It says in catastrophes, it's okay to curse and yell, because then people will view me as a go-getter and someone getting stuff done. Well, I mean, what's that story about all those school buses that were just sitting there, you know, and his people were the ones telling people to go down to the convention center that in the Superdome they were going to get bussed out, and they didn't get bussed out for days. You know, people were getting murdered and raped there. So it's his police departments that were completely ineffective and inoperable. Why didn't they have power? Why weren't they prepared? Why didn't they have contingency plans in place? I mean, I want someone to tell me why the private sector, you know, plans these things, but government doesn't. You know, we had contingency plans. We had a generator waiting to go. We had extra diesel fuel. We had food on hand. We had a plan for what do you do in case of this emergency? What do you do if you're running a data center and power goes out? Why doesn't City Hall have plans like that? You know, it takes something like a hurricane before they make one for the next one. So then this time they put in place that plan that they made after the last hurricane was a disaster, trying to get people out of the city. So then they have that contraflow. Okay, now the next hurricane hits, and okay, well, we didn't get people out fast enough. So then next time they're going to be prepared for that. But then the next thing that hits, there's going to be another aspect of it, that the looting maybe or something else. You know, it'll always be something with those people. So, you know, we didn't have any problems, and we got it right the first time. So that's what I would ask people to think about is why does the private sector in a lot of ways seem to be on the ball and get things right the first time, be ready to deliver aid, but these politicians that can make great speeches and talk real tough, you know, when are they going to start delivering, you know, anything besides a speech?
Do you think that New Orleans and Louisiana, for that matter, could start learning from Florida? Because I know their hurricane preparedness is very smooth. They have a pretty smooth transition for getting people out and then coming back in and fixing things.
Or Cuba, for that matter.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's. I think the city or state could learn from anybody if you want to know the truth. The way they run things down here, it's corrupt. You know, we had that one governor's election that was David Duke versus Edwin Edwards. Eventually, both of the guys were in jail, and that's who we got to choose from to pick for a governor for that election.
Excellent.
Wow. You know what I'm saying? It's like this state and this city could learn from basically a six-year-old how to do something better if you want to know the truth. So yeah, I'm sure Florida does things more efficiently. I'm sure as bad as Florida is, maybe with their election snafus and stuff, they still run things more efficiently than New Orleans or Louisiana. So yeah, I mean, to answer your question, that's the long way of answering, but the short answer is yes, of course.
Now, do you think the city is going to use this event to clean up its act, or is corruption just built into the system?
You know what the city is going to do? All those billions of dollars coming in here, you know who's going to get to decide where that goes? Did you see the article about Congressman Jefferson using the National Guard to check on his house?
Yeah.
They kept them out there waiting while they're, I mean, for him to go check his possessions.
For like an hour, right? They were out there?
Yeah. Those guys could have been in the part of the rescue effort, but no, instead they're helping it. These are the people that are going to be distributing all that money coming in. Now you tell me, who's going to end up with that money? Them and their cronies. That's how it's going to go. All that's going to do, this is going to actually enrich the people that you absolutely don't want being enriched. You know, I think, I hate to be this cynical, but I've lived here most of my life. I know how things work down here, and it's going to be worse than business as usual, because the people doing business as usual are going to have a lot more money to do business as usual with. So the answer to that question that you asked is, of course, no. It's going to be more boondoggles, not less, and they're not going to have their act cleaned up. They're going to, you know, they're just going to make a killing off of getting all that money coming down here. That's honestly how I feel about it.
But do you think...
Hopefully I'm wrong.
Yeah, hopefully. Do you think, though, with all the public attention, that they won't be able to do it quite as badly as, you know, we would all expect them to do it? Because now everyone's paying attention.
I don't think... Look, everybody's paying attention to a lot of stuff going on. Did you hear For instance, Tom DeLay the other day, or yesterday I think it was, he said that there's no more pork, no more fat to cut out of the federal budget. He said that with a straight face. That people have been paying attention to the deficit for, you know, for how long? And this federal debt. And this guy, I mean, this is the small government Republican, right? You know, and he's saying that there's no fat left to cut out, that since the Republicans got in office, you know, they've really shored things up. And that's, and I mean, that's one of the most absurd statements I've ever heard, but that was on national TV. A lot of people paying attention to that. So no, I don't think, and you know, plus Americans have short attention spans to begin with.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, to answer your question, I think it's going to be business as usual. I don't think you would need some kind of serious oversight with maybe the threat of being executed if that you get. But even down here, honestly, I don't think that would stop some of these guys. They're so crooked. Cleo Fields, you know, maybe they had him on tape taking bribes. The FBI comes down here. They put Governor Edwards in jail. You know, it's like these are the people. I mean, I know I'm cynical, and I hope listeners are saying, well, this guy, you know, whatever. And maybe I'm wrong, but I just know, all I know is what I've seen my whole life down here, and this is how it's always been, you know?
What's it going to take for NOLA to get back on track?
Well, what do you mean by back on track? I mean, I hope you don't mean business as usual, because it's not really going to take anything for them to get back to business as usual, being corrupt and that kind of thing, but to actually get the city improved, there's a whole bunch of overhauls that are going to need to happen. And one of them would be, you know, they're going to have to do something about the anti-business climate that they have down here. You know, there's like a 9% sales tax down here. That drives business away. There's all kinds of corruption with parking and scams where people are getting, you know, fake tickets and stuff from these people, from this private company that handles all the parking and that kind of thing. And the cost of doing business skyrockets when your customers are always getting ticketed in front of your business. There's you know, things are going to have to be done about the flooding situation, because it's obvious that the levees are inadequate. You know, then we have such a poor lower class here. They get horrible educations in the worst schools in the nation. And something has to be done about that. And again, who are we going to turn to fix that? Government? You know, I don't have any faith in government to fix the public school system. So, I mean, it's like there's so many aspects to culture down here that need to be reformed, and to government that need to be reformed, that, I mean, if you ask me, I wouldn't even know where to start. And that's after the cleanup takes place. And just looking around, the cleanup's going to take months. This place looks like a war zone minus the bullet holes, basically.
All right, well, let's move on here. I think Emily had a question for you.
Your fiance Crystal was with you in the building for a long time. Was she with you from the beginning?
She came in on the Sunday morning before the storm hit, and she left, I don't know, was it a week ago? Maybe a week ago, maybe more, before I got her out of here. So yeah, she was here for a while, like a trooper. I mean, she pulled her weight, did whatever she could do to help. You know, she's not a computer technician, so she couldn't do anything on that respect, and you know, I wasn't going to have her carrying a gun and manning a post or anything like that, but you know, she did what she could do, and that was she helped with the flow of information. If you know, I was out doing something, she had, you know, she could talk to the owners and get information or pass information to them. She did some cooking, you know, she did some comforting when I was maybe a little stressed or sore, you know. Just little things like giving me a massage or rubbing my hair or something when I was trying to concentrate on figuring out what our next move would be, that kind of thing. So she pulled her weight and did anything that she could do to be helpful around here, which, you know, I'm so proud of her for the way that she didn't complain once, you know, even though the situation is less than ideal living conditions, sleeping on the floor and that kind of thing. Just absolute trooper.
See, who says models don't give back to society?
No kidding. I mean, she's a wonderful, wonderful woman.
So why did she stay as long as she did?
Well, she stayed. It was pretty safe. I figured if you're gonna ride out a storm, this is the place to do it. But the reason I didn't get her out of here earlier was because the situation was so tenuous out there. I wanted to make sure that she was going to safely be able to make it to a location where she could fly out from. And I just was not secure in her safety up to the time that I got her out of there. Before then, I couldn't be comfortable enough to get her in a car with anybody and have her driven out of town. I mean, I didn't know if she could get carjacked or anything like that. So I waited until I felt like it was an appropriate time.
Was she the inspiration for the name Camp Crystal?
Oh, yeah. Outpost Crystal. That's where I got the name from.
What did she think of that?
She hasn't said. I think she may have smiled or grinned, but she hasn't really... how can I put it? She was never really immersed in the situation. She just basically did what she could do and never really got too involved with the blog or involved with the media or involved with the ongoing, you know, she basically tried to keep her life as normal as possible. It was very weird. It was a very weird situation to watch her perform here. It was like she was here, but she wasn't really immersing herself in the situation like a lot of us were. I mean, I had to, because I had to make sure I was aware of every threat that I could think of and that kind of thing. But she basically... almost looked at it. I mean, I'm speaking for her now, and I don't know that I'm correct in this, but my observation is that she almost was just looking at this as some kind of vacation gone awry or something, where she was just making the best of things. And so she didn't really say anything about Camp Crystal or Outpost Crystal or anything like that. She just really, it almost seemed like she didn't notice.
How has your personal morale changed since she's left?
I mean, it's dropped somewhat. I don't know how much, but it's dropped enough that, you know, I miss her. Part of me feels better that she is in sunny Florida and safe and not in this rat hole right now. But, you know, obviously I miss her, and you know, I miss being close to her and having her here with me and you know, helping out and just being there, someone I can talk to and that kind of thing. So, of course, my morale drops some, but I mean, part of what we're doing here is to, you know, if your morale drops, you just suck it up and ignore it. And you know, you don't whine about it. You just keep doing what you're supposed to do, and you put it out of your mind. So, I mean, if you start dwelling on stuff like that, then you won't be able to do your job as effectively. And there'll be plenty of time to look back later on and say, man, I guess that was the turning point when she left or whatever. But, you know, while you're here and doing it, it's just not the right time. So... I try not to dwell on the morale thing too much, but it's noticeable, you know. I've noticed it.
Now, I know you mentioned earlier you plan on living in Tampa, Florida, and moving on with your life, and I've read on your blog that you're going to be looking for work in Tampa, so I want to give you a help out here. Maybe some of our listeners live in Tampa. What sort of work are you looking for?
Well, honestly, I got to say, since I wrote the second time mentioning that I was, you know, first time I wrote something about needing work, I said Florida or California probably. Since then, I realized we were definitely going to move to Florida, so then I wrote one about Florida. I've got so many responses saying that it's silly for me to look for a job when there's one staring me right in the face, which is do my own consulting, you know, start my own consulting company. And I thought about it. And I thought about what the startup cost would be for something like that, and what service I could actually contribute to business doing that. And I think they're right. And I think what I am going to do is start my own consulting company. So instead of people looking to have people hire me to do the work they're doing, what I would ask is any of your listeners that are interested in disaster preparedness consulting, or physical security, or testing of physical security, or any of those kind of things, developing emergency plans, go ahead and look me up, because I think that's what I'm going to do is get into that line of work, start a consulting firm that will evaluate and then help companies produce their own, you know, emergency plans. You know, I think I do have pretty good experience with that, not only from here, but with the military as well. So I think that's what I'm going to try and do is be my own boss in that respect.
It's like the plot of Sneakers, except with natural disasters and things like that.
Yeah.
So how long, you said you lived in New Orleans your whole life before this?
Well, on and off. I mean, we moved here when I was 3, and I lived here up until I joined the military at age 18, then, of course, I was around with the military, but I was always back here, too. And then I did a brief stint in Florida for a couple of years. But other than that, yeah, I mean, I've lived here. Let's see, I'm 34. I probably lived here about 28 or 27 of my 34 years.
And this is it? You're going to move out now?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's for a number of reasons. I think since I am going to be starting a family, since I think I will have better opportunities elsewhere than here, and just because I do love the beach so much, I mean, I can't emphasize, I'm such a beach guy, and I've missed the beach a lot. The last time I was really at the beach with any kind of consistency was in 1996 when I was stationed at Fort Bragg. I would go down to Myrtle Beach almost every weekend, and I miss it so much. And I just think I feel healthier at the beach and that kind of thing. So I'm ready to start new somewhere else. I'm sure I'll be back to visit if things pick up. You know, I love the seafood down here, you know, and the nightlife, and I like Mardi Gras and all that kind of stuff. So I'll probably come back and visit. And my parents aren't going anywhere. They're still going to be here. So, you know, I'll be back, but not to live. I think I'll just visit. I'll be a tourist next time I come back.
Are all your friends and family okay?
Yeah, everyone's accounted for, and you know, my family all made out really well, and my friends, typical of these guys, you know, I am. If they say that you know, you can tell a person's character by the company they keep, I think people, you know, must think highly of me, because the caliber of friends I have, they're something else, man. Some of my friends were out there actually plucking people out of the water in their boats, even though the police were telling them not to, and this and that. And oh, man, there's some stories about how the FEMA guys, they would idle their boats at you know, two knots or whatever you want to call it, to pull people out, whereas all the civilians were just flying by, snatching people, going back and forth, and getting the job done. They didn't have the stupid regulations to abide by and everything. And they were blatantly ignoring the orders not to help, because they knew these people didn't have an extra night to live, you know, that the water could still be rising and that kind of thing. So one of my friends, Robert LeBlanc, for instance, yeah, he made out all right, but he didn't just make out. He went and saved lives when this thing was going on, and I'm very proud of him. I'm so proud of so many of my friends for the way that they acted during this, you know, ordeal.
Now, there's no question that your blog has been providing a valuable service and actually helping people, if even just to let them know the truth about what's happening in the city. Now, do you have any stories that you can share with us about people who have been directly affected by the blog and what you're doing out there?
Well, I think, you know, if you read the Bigfoot interview that I had, I don't know if you guys remember that one. That was the guy that was out at the convention center, and he was telling me about the horrible conditions out there and how they've been waiting and waiting for the buses, and they still hadn't gotten there. I put that on the blog. And then a few days later, I don't know, maybe a week later, he was in an interview with some show called Rents. I guess it's the Rents.com or something. This guy did an interview of Bigfoot again, and Bigfoot said that the very next day after the blog came out, they had police flooding the area, reassuring the people that they were definitely getting help, and then all of a sudden the food came, and it wasn't being pushed off the bridge like it was before, but they were actually being fed. And then the buses came that day and picked them up. So he attributed it to the blog. I can't say one way or the other. Some people have speculated that the blog was being read by people, you know, in positions of power, and someone said, hey, you know, this is a public relations disaster. Get on that or something. And that's probably the closest thing I could say to an actual, you know, service where maybe a life saved or people's lives were saved. Now, I know we've helped out businesses when I put up on the blog that we would be, you know, some people have been contacting us already, asking us if we could go pull their servers or their computers, that kind of thing, so they could get their critical data or get their payroll and all that kind of stuff so they could pay their employees. We've been helping people like that, too, and that wouldn't have happened for the blog also. So, I mean, there's a few ways. But honestly, I don't want to overplay the importance of the blog. It was never intended to be anything but a way for me to communicate with my friends. And then when it did blow up and become a media thing, I tried to do what I could to help with it, but, you know, I don't want to make myself out to be a hero or a savior, anything like that, because I mean, like I said, my friend Robert, he's a hero. He was down there pulling people out of the water. You know, I was just, you know, passing information along for the most part and doing what I could to help from where I was, you know, while I was trying to do my regular job. So, I'd like to think I would have been one of the guys doing what Robert had done if I were down on the ground. I guess I did what I figured I could do from where I was. But I definitely don't want people blowing it up out of proportion. Like you know, a lot of people have been writing saying hero this and hero that, and that's just not fair because, you know, I was passing on information, but except for a couple of times where we had some intruders and that kind of thing, I wasn't really in mortal danger like some people. And I was pretty well supplied, and I had it a lot better than a lot of people on the ground. So, you know, I would feel guilty, people calling me that. But, yeah, I mean, we tried to help, and we helped where we could, and I hope we did help a lot of people, you know.
I know for me, one of the things I really liked about the blog and the site and stuff like that were just, it was both, I think, your timeliness and your honesty, you know, where when the news would say one thing, you'd say, that's not what's going on here. And you never tried to sugarcoat it ever, you know, and I always appreciated that. And reading some of the comments that were there, other people did as well. And one of the things for me, again, was the timeliness of it. You would post something and then I'd hear about it on the news a day or two later, you know, and I know, I think the most poignant moment for me watching, because now, for people who don't know the geography, the building they're in is just up the street from the convention center. They're not very far away. The most poignant moment for me was watching the convoy of buses heading toward the convention center for the first time those people were going to be saved. And I saw it live because of the webcam you guys had set up. And that was so exciting. I can't even describe that moment. I was so elated that those people were going to get the help they needed and just seeing bus after bus. I mean, there were easily over 100 buses headed that way, and oh, they just kept coming. It was such a great moment.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that from a lot of people, that I would post first, or they would see it on the cam, and then you know, they'd hear it in the news. But I think I had an advantage in that respect, in that, like you said, I do know the geography of the area. I, you know, and a lot of times the news could have just been just unfamiliar with the area or something, so maybe they reported something that was incorrect, not because, you know, they're just dumb or anything, but maybe they just misunderstood something about the street names or anything like that. But also, I think I kind of knew what to look for down here too, you know, because I know the area. I know pretty much where the higher elevation is, where the lower elevation is, what the grid kind of looks like, you know, because the city loses power all the time. Every time we have a big storm, you know, the power goes down. So I think I just being from here, being in a good location, like, I mean, in the Central Business District, we're in, like, the central area of the Central Business District, so we have a wide view of everything. So I think I don't think it's due to any, like, spectacular work on my part so much as just basically a natural advantage of location and familiarity and that kind of thing. So now what I didn't like was when, you know, the news would get so eager to report something that they would just be, you know, throw the wrong stuff out there. I can't think of I had an example on tip of my tongue a minute ago, but I don't remember what it was. But it might have been something about the conditions at the convention center or who was getting help or something like that. But anyway, yeah, it was, you know, or maybe they said that the whole CBD was flooded or something like that. I forget. But, you know, I had an advantage that they didn't, that most of the media didn't have. So that's what I would attribute most of that to. But I'm glad that, you know, I did manage to help with getting information out there, definitely.
So what sort of media attention has your blog gotten just as a result of being out there? And have you gotten as a result? I know you've done other interviews, and other people there have done other interviews.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, CNN, MSNBC, some of those satellite radio stations, BBC, NPR, I mean, newspapers, a lot of stuff. And honestly, it's maybe I should have been keeping better track, but, you know, hopefully someone out there will compile whatever they can find on that and send it to me. But, you know, people would call and say, you know, can we talk to you for a few minutes or something? I'd say, sure, and talk to them. And I wouldn't necessarily even get where they were or who they were or what it was with. And honestly, I mean, it didn't really matter. I figured they were just going to try and put the word out on what was going on, and I kind of liked it more when it wasn't about the blog as much, but, you know, okay, what are you seeing out there now? What's going on out there now? So, I mean, I never really bothered that much with the big names like CNN and stuff like that. Obviously, I'm going to remember that I did those, but a lot of the other stuff, maybe a newspaper in New Jersey, I did that the other day, but I don't even remember the name of it and that kind of thing. So, you know, that has definitely not been, you know, the thing people have to remember is we're still doing a job here, like trying to keep this data center up, and it is not, I mean, there's little tricks to that are going on all the time with, you know, the city turned the grid on the other day, and that threw us for a loop because we had to go down and do a manual override of the generator and make sure that we were back on power. We had to get off of battery power briefly. I mean, the smallest thing can throw everything out of whack, and so that's still the primary concern is that data center, keeping this thing up and running. And the media stuff and all of that, I mean, I'm sure one day I'll be glad I did it. Maybe, you know, maybe there'll be a book or something. Whatever, that'll be nice, but it just has not been my focus. I'm just trying to get the word out or help in any way I can as far as that goes. But now that I'm thinking about it and you're asking, if anyone out there wants to go ahead and make a compilation of all the appearances that they can find or whatever that I've done, I would love to have it, see what people wrote about me. That's the other thing. A lot of people are forgetting to send me links and stuff after they actually put it up. So, you know, I don't even get to read the story that they write about me or you know, the transcript or anything.
Considering,
I guess I'd like to.
Considering the role you've played, I wouldn't be surprised if we see an Interdictor Wikipedia entry eventually.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's one on New Orleans.
There's a Katrina one. I know
that.
Yeah,
okay. And I think someone put the blog in there, but they've made an IRC channel, you know, but I hardly have gone, I've never really used IRC, so I don't even, I tried to go in there a few times, but, you know, then there's work to do and stuff, so right. It's like, it kind of took on a life of its own. Someone, there's a game called Magic the Gathering, I think, where you play with cards or something, and someone was showing me some cards that were made just today or yesterday, and they had all, it was about the storm, and you know, you slap a politician card down and get +2 to bureaucracy or not some nonsense. And there was actually a card or two about me, something about a citizen, you know, and you get a +2 to defense of your location or some nonsense. You know,
that's
all
awesome.
Kinds of crazy stuff has been popping up regarding it. It's funny, but I haven't really had time to sit down and actually appreciate it all. And I guess I'm going to want to eventually, so... You know, again, anyone out there that wants to compile something like that for me, I'd appreciate it.
Now, a couple of times, and you touched on this earlier, you stressed that the media is misrepresenting or embellishing the facts. What do you think it's important for people to know about the state of New Orleans right now, as it is?
I think people are dreaming if they think it's going to be back to normal, whatever that is, anytime soon. I hear what they're saying. And honestly, Jefferson Parish might be back to normal pretty soon, but it didn't take it as bad as the city did. I think first thing you have to remember is all the citizens basically got bussed out. Then businesses have been completely wiped out here. It's a poor city to start with. A lot of the infrastructure is really damaged. You know, the levees had breaches in them. And I just, looking around and surveying the damage and where's the incentive for people to come back and that kind of thing? They would have to do a complete 180 and be a pro-business climate. First, you got to lure the businesses back if you want to have people here. You know, you got to have goods and services to buy. You've got to have employment. You know, so you got to have business down here. They're going to have to do something serious to get business down here. Now, sure, a huge, you know, influx of money from the federal government might entice people to come down, but I mean, again, it depends on how that's going to get sold out and this and that. But I think that the media and I think that the politicians down here are grossly overstating the capacity for recovery for this area. I mean, I've heard estimates that October 2nd, it'll take till October 2nd or so before all the water is pumped out of the city. I mean, this thing hit, you know, what, August, at the end of August. You look in October 2nd, that's a month and change of water that's been just sitting, you know, not fermenting, but whatever you want to call it, you know, the rot and the nastiness and the biological contamination and everything, it's going to I think people are just, I think the media and the politicians are just grossly overestimating the capacity of for the city to recover. I heard some of Bush's speech before we got on the phone, and, you know, again, that's great rhetoric, but, well, actually, it's not, because he can't deliver a speech to save his life. So it's mediocre, it's great speech writing, poor delivery, mediocre rhetoric, I guess you could say, you know, I think it's wishful thinking or BS, you know. At best, wishful thinking, at worst, it's a bunch of garbage. I don't have high hopes for the recovery of this city anytime soon. I think 10 years, maybe things will be back to normal. I can't imagine a big Mardi Gras coming up. I know that they're going to say it's going to be huge, but I think it'll be one of the most disappointing Mardi Gras ever, for instance.
Yeah, you know, you talked before on your blog about being optimistic, pessimistic, and realistic. Do you think they're just trying to be optimistic as opposed to realistic?
Well, let's face it. I mean, it's in their best interest to play everything up. You know, if you sit and say, there's no, you know, it's going to be 10 years before things recover, well, it's not a lot of business is even going to try and come down. So you got to give, you know, and I can understand that. They're trying to give the, look, you know, we're going to build bigger, you know, even Bush was saying that tonight. We're not just going to rebuild, we're going to build bigger and more magnificent, you know. Yeah, whatever. I mean, sure you will. And if you do, that probably just means the next hurricane that hits is going to be more expensive than the last one. But, you know, good luck, and God bless you with that. I hope it works. But they've got to kind of pump it up. They've got to hype it and shill it, because if they don't, you know, they're not going to have any chance to get business back. So you got to, you know, I can understand why they're doing it. I don't agree that they should, but, I can understand where they're coming from. So I think that's what their motivation is.
Now, I heard on a financial show, I think it was MSNBC, one of those, that they were discussing the economy of the area is going to change, that the lower class who were able to get out and who are gone and looking for jobs now because they really have no point in going home, that it's going to change the economy to more of a middle class kind of community rather than what it was before. Do you see that happening more, or do you think
let's be frank, I'm not going to be politically correct and mince words. They bust, you know, hundreds of thousands of poor, black, uneducated citizens out. People that were stuck in cyclical poverty because they were being housed on government housing in those crime-ridden projects, and the only outs that they had were either to go to the worst public schools in the country or, you know, maybe try and make a life as a drug dealer or something, and then get thrown in jail because of the war on drugs. So there was almost no opportunity for them, you know. I hope people understand. I'm just being a realist and explaining what the situation is. You know, I'm not condemning these people or anything, because if I had been born, you know, into that situation, I wouldn't be any different than any of the other people in there, and none of us would be. And I don't think that they're bad people. I think that they're victims of circumstance for the most part. And I think that's what we're talking about, though. So let's be honest. It's they bust all the poor black people out of the city. Well, that means that the people that are left are mostly probably middle class white people, and the city was about 66% black and poor, and the schools were failing, that kind of thing. Now, if you're asking, now that's the case, a lot of people are speculating that the whole dynamic's going to change. Well, I mean, it might, or the wealthier people might say, you know, the city's not the same. First of all, it'd be a much smaller city if those people don't come back. You're going to have the population's going to be, maybe a third of what it was. So that means you've got this big area, and then you're going to only have a few people living here. Well, you're going to have a lot of houses that are going to be condemned. You're going to have, like, a lot of business buildings that are going to be sitting there. People paying property tax on stuff they're not using. I mean, it's hard to say exactly how the dynamic would change, you know, but there's a lot of elements to it. Frankly, I don't know that it would make the community wealthier or anything like that. I think it would, you know, I think what would make it, what would be best would be for the residents, even, you know, the poor black residents to come back, but to have opportunity. for instance, mm-hmm. get rid of the failed public schools and let these people get some real education. Give them vouchers for housing and take them off of these reservations that we call public housing projects, so that they can mingle into the middle-class communities. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? I think why collect all the poor people and put them in one spot when you could give them vouchers and let them integrate into middle-class communities? It's much more uplifting that way. You know, you're growing up, you're not surrounded by nothing but poverty and crime. Now you see something to aspire to, and you're in a middle-class neighborhood, and you've got some hope for the future. And give them vouchers to go to private schools or something so that they're not stuck in the worst schools in the country, because now you can actually make something of yourself. So I think that, you know, I don't think that the hope for New Orleans is to keep the poor people out. Like, I know a lot of people are speculating, okay, it's going to be a white middle class society mm-hmm. now. I don't think that's what's going to make New Orleans better. I think giving the poor people that come back an opportunity to better themselves and their kids, what the future of the city would really be, should be banking on. Because, I mean, that's how you build the community back up. Not just busting out the people that, you know, are already in a lower class. I mean, that doesn't solve anything, I don't think, honestly.
So do you think if the government really, like the corruptness of the government didn't have a say in where the money went, that many of the citizens of New Orleans would want to do that, would want to help build up the poorer communities and bring them back and give them a better way of life than they had before they had to leave?
Well, I don't think the government should really be involved in it too much at all. I think it's the government involvement that's the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, the government runs the schools and stuff, and that's, you know, you want my opinion would be I would abolish the private schools. And I would make, I would let some kind of private school situation. And, you know, at first, you wouldn't be able to buy the best education if you were poor. You wouldn't be able to buy the best education for your kids. But you know what? You'd be able to buy a better education than you would mm-hmm. in the public schools. Because they're not getting any education right now, you know? At least they would get something. You know what I mean? Is that kind of what you were asking?
Or? Yeah.
Like, yeah, I think if we could clean up the corruption and allow people to help their neighbors and maybe private charities and encourage people, you know this old saying about teach them the fish, don't just give them a fish, that kind of thing. Well, the government just gives fish, okay? That's mm-hmm. all they do. They don't teach people to fish. You know, they warehouse people in these public schools. They don't teach them anything in the public schools. And so it's that kind of thing, I think. You know, if we could clean up some of that, you know, there would be some real hope. But I have no reason to think that that would ever happen. You know, not down here. It's too much politics. The schools have nothing to do with education down here, and everything to do with politics and power. And if you ever get a chance to do any research on it, you will want to cry. You know, there was some saying. One of the guys said something to the effect of he was like a lawyer or an advocate for the teachers union, and said something to the effect of the day that students start paying my salary or whatever it is, you know, paying for my services, that's when I'll be representing the interests of the students. You know, and that was a guy for the teachers union saying that. So, I mean, you know, it's so many things have to change before things get better.
So I have three questions that I ask everybody that we interview, and mm-hmm. these might be familiar if you've ever watched Inside the Actors Studio. The first question is, what is your favorite word?
Okay, it doesn't have to be a curse word, does it?
It can if you want it to be, but it doesn't have to be.
Just any word you like.
My favorite word. My favorite word would probably be chocolate.
Why is that?
Because I'm a chocoholic. I'm in a big way. I've been living on a lot of chocolate out here. You know, little chocolates, brownies, chocolate cakes. You know, little petty snacks, stuff like that. I love chocolate chip cookies. I think my favorite, if I hear the word chocolate, I think I'm like Pavlov's dog. So yeah, chocolate's probably my favorite word.
All right, the next question is, what turns you on creatively, spiritually, or emotionally?
A challenge. I like, you know, I hate to say it because people get the wrong idea, but situations like what I'm in, that's what does it for me, because I've found, for whatever reason, that most people crack under pressure. Most people aren't used to pain. They don't perform well when they're suffering. They start concentrating on the aches and pains and the suffering. They don't pay attention to what else they should be doing. I found that for whatever reason, I think it was the way I was raised by my dad, that I have an advantage in some ways, and I almost look as a challenge when the chips are down and things are tough. You know, that's when I feel like I'm at my best. That's when I feel, you know, most empowered in those ways that you were described, emotionally and spiritually and whatnot. So I would say, especially crisis situations or very challenging situations.
Finally, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Oh, I would love to be an astronaut, no doubt about it. I always, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut until my dad explained to me that it was going to take, you know, a couple of PhDs, like in astrophysics and whatnot. Anyone knows the fast track to becoming an astronaut, let me know, because that has been, you know, a lifelong dream in some way. But you know, I've never been able to apply myself toward those ends. Just on the hope that one day I would get shot up into space if I had the right degrees and went to the right branches of the military and stuff. So I never pursued it because I didn't think it would be likely anyway. But man, I love to go up into space one day, no doubt.
Well, if you happen to find a fast track, do let me know, because I would also love to do that.
I hear if you have $100 million, there's a private company that's going to be shuttling people into space.
I think it's like a little bit less than that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty
but
soon.
But then the price, you know, remember, like, computers used to be expensive before, but
yeah.
But as it gets mass marketed, it'll come down. So I'm sure one day it'll probably only cost $2 or $3 million to go up into space.
And, you know, once the government gets out of it, right?
When yeah.
It. See? Well, there we go. It all exactly. Comes full circle.
How much does it cost to shoot the space shuttle up compared to, you know, those other people spent $10 million and got that...
Spaceship One?
Yeah. And what they only paid like $10 million to get that thing up there, whereas...
I think it was 20, know, but still.
Well, okay, yeah, something like that, but yeah. And it worked, and it came down, and, you know, it was pretty problem-free with the space shuttle. Every time it goes up, we have to pray that, you know, nothing flew off of it or something. So, you know, that's the bureaucracy versus the private sector.
Michael, I want to thank you so much for not only just giving us as much of your time as you have this evening, but for keeping up the blog and for keeping that 2% of the internet running.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to come on and hopefully shed some light on you know, what I've seen and what's been going on up here. And thanks a lot, guys, you know, for having me. And, you know, I hope you get a positive feedback from this.
I hope so, too, and yeah. I'll certainly send you the URL later on so you can check it out when I post the podcast.
I appreciate that.
Thanks, Michael. You have a good evening.
All right. Thank you. You guys, too.
Be safe and tell Crystal we said hi.
I'll do that. Bye-bye.
Night.
Bye.
The day after we recorded this interview, Michael was relieved of his post and is headed to Tampa, Florida. His goals for the immediate future are to plan his wedding.